7 out of 25 of the ATMPs in Europe have been withdrawn from the market, primarily for commercial reasons. It's a real travesty. And mm-hmm. we saw that with Bluebird when they withdrew two gene therapies for the rare disease patient populations in Europe. We've seen it with others. It's a flashing yellow light of caution for patient access.
Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about Ori's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech, and I'll be the host for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Foster. And today we're lucky to have Tim Hunt, who is the CEO of the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, better known as ARM to most of the industry. Tim, welcome and thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Jason, for having me.
Where are we talking to you today? Whereabouts in the world are you?
I am in the greater Boston area.
Is that home? I can't remember.
It is. I've been in the Boston area for many, many years. I'm a diehard Celtics fan, which these days is a little bit up and down. But
more up than down this year. That was good. So excellent. Well, let's kick it off by I'd love to pick your brain on just some of the kind of incredible momentum we're seeing in the cell and gene therapy space. In a relatively young industry, everything's a first almost, but we're seeing, 10-year longitudinal data. We celebrated with Emily Whitehead and her family, her 10-year cancer-free anniversary. We see lots of clinical work expanding beyond hematological tumors into solid tumors and even beyond cancer into, very interesting applications in maybe even diabetes or cardiovascular disease or autoimmune disease, some interesting data. First allogeneic approval in Europe. So there's been a lot of kind of action in the field over the last, let's say, 12 to 18 months. But we'd love to hear from you. What are your highlights so far in 2023 now that we're almost halfway through?
Yeah, let me even step back a little bit more.
Please.
That, right? So if you think about, you expand back over the last, you talk to people that have been in the field 20, 30 years even, right? Like, especially mm-hmm. on the gene therapy side, it was a long, hard slog. Some of the prominent academics in the field were there when they were made the major setbacks in the late 1990s. And so for years, it felt like kind of, crawling across broken glass, really kind of working forward, two steps forward, two steps back, right?
Yes.
And then suddenly, starting about 5-6 years ago, right, we start seeing the first gene therapies approved in the United States, and really an explosion of the technology that led us to where we were, I think, last year, where we suddenly saw lots of approvals. And then this year, where we're looking at a couple dozen or a dozen or so, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's a major inflection point, a really a seminal year for the field. And you noted Emily Whitehead, of course, the first pediatric patient for CAR-T therapy. I had the pleasure of meeting Tom Whitehead shortly after I started last September in Rome. And then we invited them to come to a briefing in Brussels mm-hmm. that we did in November. And I got to spend time with Emily. I mean, it's really, she's got a very, very special story that I think is important for people to know. And so directly to your question, I think there's a few things, right? So the February European approval of Hemgenix from CSL Behring and Unicure was certainly a major milestone.
Yeah, Gamida Cell's
approval for their cell therapy for hematological malignancies, big milestone. And then not that long ago, May 19th, Krystal Biotech just got their first approval for their gene therapy working on dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa. Let's call
easy for you to say.
EBD for short.
Yeah,
exactly. But that's an often fatal skin blistering.
It looks absolutely terrible. I mean, just looking at a patient suffering with that, it's just got to be incredible.
It's very difficult. I met a patient with EB last October at our meeting on the Mesa, and so this is a major advance for that community, and one of hopefully will just be of many down the road. So a huge year and a lot of early milestones, I think, that mark it with a lot more to come.
Yeah. And that is interesting even further because it's a topical application, right? It's not an infusion. Is it cream or an application to the skin directly? Is that right?
Yeah. Gene therapy applied to the skin. There'll be repeat dosing. It kind of works lesion by lesion. but a major breakthrough.
Amazing.
Yeah, really cool.
And you mentioned Humegenix and a couple others that are starting to expand into larger patient populations, you know, and we're looking at potentially, I think, an approval this year for sickle cell, perhaps from, I think, Vertex and CRISPR or have filed and are looking at that potentially. So we're starting to see more and more kind of larger patient populations that have the potential to be helped by this new generation of medicines. That, while fantastic, of course, that we're having more and more approvals, adds potentially to the challenges we're already having with access. Obviously, when we have lots of patients who need therapy, we've struggled with how do we serve, you know, even smaller patient populations thus far. And you and I have discussed this at length. You know, we've got the potential to have a target patient population of over 1 million patients next year that could benefit from this new generation of incredible therapies. And access is tough today. In fact, you know, in your state of the industry update in January at JP Morgan, which I attended, you said something that really struck me. And you said, and I'm trying to quote you here, but let me know if I get it wrong, essentially that the status quo in cell and gene therapy for most patients today represents death or serious disability. And I really kind of took note of that in, you know, really kind of a strong call to action as an industry of, you know, we're only on the early stages, the job's not done yet. But I wonder kind of if you could kind of build on that, what drove you to say that? And what do you view as the urgent needs for the industry to really address now?
Yeah, so I think the job is not done yet. I think we're really at the, you know, at the end of the beginning in many ways, despite the fact that the field's been around for decades, right?
Yes.
We're just now seeing real approvals. And to your point, the impact, the positive impact that can happen for patients, I think, is just in the earliest days. So, you know, what drove me to say it? I mean, look, I think it's a big deal that in our field, we make sure that we're collectively, we're very clear on what's our true north, right? And that is the patient, right? And the reality is for these patients, as I noted back in January and believe very strongly today, that the status quo does represent death or serious disability. Why? Right? So you look at some of the disorders. No one's taking a gene therapy or a gene editing medicine or a cell therapy if they've got a mild condition, right? These are tend to be grievously ill patients.
Yes.
They are dying from cancer. And they are kind of taking a break the glass moment and reaching for CAR T therapy with their oncology team, or they have a rare disorder that is not well controlled,
right,
and they're going for something that's very powerful, right? And so we see cases like, as you know, like with sickle cell disease, right? So the average sickle cell patient passes away by the time they're 45. That's in the United States, right? Much in other parts of the world, right? I've met probably 7 or 8 sickle cell patients over the last several years. 3 of them I'm aware of passed away. 2 of them were in their 30s. 1, I would guess, was in his 40s, right? Way, way too young. And so good news is help is on the way in some of these areas, right? As you noted, with some, hopefully we'll get 2 approvals for sickle cell disease this year, which would be terrific for the community. And so, and we talked about EB a moment ago, right? These are tough, tough disorders. And I think it's incumbent on many of us to, A, remember that ourselves, right? We sometimes get so close to the technology that we kind of almost lose sight of the burden of illness on the patients. And it's up to us to remember it first and foremost, and then make sure we're communicating it loudly and consistently and powerfully, I believe, to major stakeholders. And that includes payers, regulators, right, policy leaders, the media, investors, to make sure that they see the impact that these medicines can potentially have on patients, which is transformative.
Absolutely. And I think I agree wholeheartedly with all of that. And I often say that, you know, as an industry, we need to focus not only on approvability, but also accessibility and affordability. You know, it's sort of, as an industry for so long, we've been focused on getting it through the regulatory process, getting it through clinical trials, getting it approved. And we've seen some really unfortunate failures. You know, you and I've talked about in Europe where there've been removals of very clinically effective products that just couldn't make a commercial case to really manufacture and serve that, those patient populations that needed them. You know, they couldn't be afforded, they couldn't be accessed, the cost of goods were too high, manufacturing was too small, all the things that we know are sort of preventing open access today, you know, play out. And I think something like 7 or 8 approved gene therapies have been removed from Europe that have been approved there. And it's not that the patient need went away. It was rather that these other considerations you know, had to come to the fore. So definitely more work to do, as you said, and hopefully, you know, ARM and organizations like ARM and companies like ORI and the industry can work together to really try and solve these problems at scale, because ultimately we all want the same thing. We all want patients to get widespread access and to have the impact of these therapies to be massive and positive for patients. And one of the ways I think, you know, ARM contributes to that bigger mission for patients is really kind of, as you said, making the right data available for the right stakeholders. You know, how does the industry look at some of these issues? How do policymakers look at some of these issues? And love to hear more about that kind of policy mission at ARM, maybe in a few minutes. But, you know, one of the things that we rely on heavily is some of the ARM, you know, State of the Union reports and quarterly updates and kind of what's the trajectory? How is the industry progressing? You know, even things like counting clinical trials, counting, you know, the amount of money raised in the field. And, you know, I'd love to learn more about kind of how and why you guys do those things and what uses you see for those data, you know, what kind of stakeholders you interface with that rely on those data like we do, and just really kind of part of the, you know, broader mission of ARM beyond some of the obvious things.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's helpful. I think it's helpful to do a few things, right? When communicating with a lot of these important stakeholders, like the folks I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. right? So it's regulators, it's payers, it's policy leaders, it's investors, media, patient community, right? It's important to bring, I think, a couple of things to bear. One is, you know, rigorous analysis of policy options and things people can do. I think it's very helpful to bring the patient voice right to a lot of these important stakeholders so they mm-hmm. can kind of hear it very loudly and powerfully. And you need data. You got to bring data along. And there's a lot in out there. But one of the tricks, of course, is, again, despite the fact that the field has essentially been around for about 30 years, it's really still, in many ways, a nascent industry. And mm-hmm. so getting data can be a little tricky, right? It's part of the secret sauce of what we try to do. It's a little bit more manual than you think. You'd think you could walk over and hit a button and like it all comes about and it's like one source of truth. Well, doesn't really work that way, right?
We learned the hard way. I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah,
in a second.
Yeah. Well, you guys have a lot of great data on mm-hmm. that I've seen you share with me on CAR-T and other things that are really a major contribution, I would say, to the field and the dialogue. And so when we put together these state of the sector reports, we try to cut through the data. We use different sources. You know, we have to triangulate sometimes. Sometimes you think, again, you go to clinicaltrials.gov, it's all going to be super easy. And then you go to the European equivalent and some of the sources in Asia. It's a little bit messy.
And
you
got apples and pears and bananas, and you're like, how do I make sense of it? Yeah.
Exactly. But we think it's a worthwhile investment. We get a lot of positive feedback from others. And by the way, we're one, as I mentioned, you guys put out some great data. A lot of organizations make very meaningful contributions to this. And I think that's all part of the broader community, right? Of people that are trying to illuminate any of a number of things. How many developers are there out there that are actually working in service of these patients? We see a little under 1,500 across the globe. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of organizations putting their shoulder to the wheel, right?
Yeah.
Look at it, clinical trials and how are they doing and where are they taking place, right? We look at investments, who's you know, where's the money coming from? So there's a lot out there that I think does help inform the community. And I think we're at the, I don't know if we're at the 1.0 or at the 2.0 version of our data, probably at the 2.0 version, but we're looking forward to coming out with more of a 3.0 and a 4.0. Because I think it is an important contribution to the field, and we do get some pretty good feedback on it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, to that point, as you said, it's sort of we went in search of combining the last two discussions around patients and around data, trying to figure out how many patients had been treated, you know, how many patients have we successfully treated. And we were just looking exclusively at the CAR-T therapy world, just as a first cut. And it was a number that no one had, no one could find, no one I asked knew the number. You know, there was a tidbit here, like, you know, Christy Shaw, the former CEO of Kite, said, you know, throughout our history, we've retreated 13,000 patients or so, I think was their number. But there was no published numbers anywhere. And so we went in search of it and unsuccessfully didn't find anything and decided, well, could we potentially calculate it ourselves? So now on the ORI website, we publish a patient access tracker, which essentially counts from 2017 until the most recent quarter. So we just updated it for 2023 first Q1. To just show how many patients are getting treated. And we've used, you know, the very scientific method of taking revenue, dividing it by price and getting patients. Now, of course, it's a bit of a blunt instrument, but if we continue to calculate it that way, at least we can sort of see trends. And, you know, Q1 looks like, you know, 2023 will be a record breaking year, you know, over 8,000 patients treated this year. Hopefully if we project that number forward versus less than 7,000 last year, now, you know, those are,
That's a great increase and certainly awesome for those 8,000 patients.
And, you know, I guess the question for us is what do we need to do to make those numbers, you know, to add a zero to some of those numbers, which is really the kind of big ambition for us.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the data that you've shared with me is, and that's up on your website, it's super cool. And as you said, it's a little bit of a blunt instrument. Okay. You acknowledge that, right? But you're adding to the dialogue and the community, which I think is a huge service to people. And people can come and say, hey, I've got another way of looking at it or add to it. Great. Okay. And it will kind of collectively further the discussion, which I think is the point, as I understand it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think it kind of goes back to your point earlier about this access thing. I mean, we worship at the chapel of modernizing healthcare systems at the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, right? That we come along with this powerful new technology. It's fundamentally different than the way these systems were built over decades, right? So if you look at the European health technology assessment bodies and some of the ways we think about reimbursement and some of the government programs, right? A lot of these systems were built around the pills, as I say, of the 1970s, right? They just haven't been modernized that often.
No.
And not that bad people are running them, they're not, but they just, you know, being what it is, government systems sometimes just don't catch up. And we're seeing some real efforts right now in real time to modernize these health systems. And I think it's good to specifically kind of fit around cell and gene therapy, and it's needed, right? The 7 out of 25 of the ATMPs in Europe have been withdrawn from the market, primarily for commercial reasons. We saw it's a real trap. And we saw that with Bluebird when they withdrew two gene therapies for the rare disease patient populations in Europe. We've seen it with others. It's a flashing yellow light of caution for patient access over in Europe. And so we're trying to work with others to say, hey, look, how do we, you know, let's not just stand across a bridge from each other and yell at each other. How do we actually get in, work with ATMPs, the ATMP regulatory bodies, the EMA, the HTA, the health technology assessment bodies, to see if we can find some middle path where we can actually ensure that if these therapies are being developed and being approved in Europe, there is a path for reimbursement. Probably the real approach is to figure out how can we all reasonably embrace real-world evidence in a way that works for the health technology assessment bodies and the payers, and the EMA and the biotech companies that are developing them, and importantly, the patient community that has to live with the repercussions of this more than any of us, frankly. And I think there is a reasonable path to doing that. And in the US, it's a lot around how do you think about looking at modernizing Medicaid and Medicare? I think we've got a good start on a few ideas. I'll note the MVP Act passed just recently out of committee on a bipartisan vote. That's an effort to kind of codify some of the rulemaking that's come out of CMS around Medicaid programs and how do we ensure access in a reasonable way for patients. That's a really positive development. Good that it's bipartisan.
Yes. We hope that much is these days.
Not much is these days. Not much is these days. But the sponsors of this legislation in the House and in the Senate really want to make this bipartisan, which is great. So there's clearly work to be done modernizing Medicare. There's aspects of that that I think can be really help try to increase access to CAR T therapy. So there's a lot of work to be done on modernizing healthcare systems across the board, but there's hope out there.
Yeah. And I think there are some, being an American who lives in London and spent a fair amount of time working in the European healthcare systems. There's some definite contrasts in the way, you know, reimbursement authorities and others think about access. And I would say the signals are not good, as you said, you know, flashing yellow light. I might argue it's turning red, you know, and unfortunately.
That's my optimistic hat
that's
on
right,
yellow.
That's right. Yeah. But it's not good news for patients for sure. I mean, I think the latest announcement was a couple months ago. Janssen and Legend said that they won't be able to bring Carvykti to the UK because of manufacturing challenges, but also, you know, economic reasons. And that's not good for patients with multiple myeloma, you know, here in the UK. So work certainly to be done there.
Some of us are around that spend time working in the antibiotic space. So some years ago, I worked for a company that became the largest company in the world doing antibiotic R&D to combat superbugs, right? So hospital.
AMR stuff, yeah.
Exactly. Very potent antibiotics, right? Not the stuff you put out in the community, but like really hospital-based.
Yeah.
I mean, there are very, very few companies doing work in that area now. In fact, the government is looking at paying companies to get into the space because there's been such a flood of suppliers. Well, it's a tale of what happens when reimbursement goes off the rails. And that's so right. This isn't theoretical that there could be a problem. There's data that says 7 out of the 25 ATMPs are not available now in Europe because of reimbursement, primarily because of reimbursement reasons. Data that says you can have a superbugs crisis because there aren't enough innovators out there saying, let's put shoulder to the wheel and try to help people that might die from a horrible infection. Well, it's not theoretical. This stuff doesn't just get approved and all of a sudden it works out. It's really a slog to ensure adequate reimbursement. And if that doesn't happen, it's a stone cold no for patients, which is highly problematic.
I mean, the reality is that the massive investments at risk that the pharmaceutical industry makes in these products needs to yield an ROI. You know, there's very few of them that actually make it to market, and that revenue that's generated from them is plowed into the next generation of therapies. And if we don't have any products that reach the market or make any revenues, we don't have the next generation of therapies. And that is the cold reality. And that is exactly what happened with antibiotics. No one was innovating because there wasn't any money to be made in it. I couldn't make my money back. So, you know, thinking about that and sort of the economics of this, which is no small topic, we could probably spend the whole hour discussing just this one aspect. We know that cost of goods, the cost to manufacture these products, the cost to develop them is you know, monumental, billion, at least maybe two, I hear, $1 billion to develop. And then each time we make it, it's, you know, often several hundred thousand dollars to make one individual patient's therapeutic dose.
Yes.
So cost of goods contributes to this challenge, certainly, as do, I would say, antiquated, you know, manufacturing capabilities that really just don't even allow us to physically make the products. We just can't make enough of them, even if we wanted to. We have to build massive buildings and lots of people. We still can't make enough. So how do we move forward from here in your view? I've obviously got a view. It's a lot of what Ori spends a lot of time thinking about and working towards. How do we change the economic model? You know, ultimately, I think there's innovation to be had in lots of different areas that I think can positively impact this. But I'm wondering what you think are the major levers that we can pull to try and improve the economic situation and therefore improve accessibility over, let's say, the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think it's a really important question. You guys have spoken on this a little bit very well. So, look, I think it's helpful to have kind of straight talk on some of this. There is no near term magic wand that's going to suddenly make, you know, let's pick on gene therapy for a second. It's going to make these products eminently less expensive for many of the reasons you noted. I think of it in three buckets, right? There's sort of near term, called the next 5 years. There's midterm, which probably goes 5 to 10 to 12 years, something like that. This is all kind of a bit of guesswork, of course. And then there's longer term, call it 10 plus years out, right?
Yeah.
You know, what do we hope we will see? We'll see a few things, right? A story around efficiencies that do kick in overall, including manufacturing efficiencies. Decentralized manufacturing can certainly help as one example. I think there's a lot around technical improvements and scale that will really kind of work out the kinks and allow, you know, manufacturing challenges to kind of get worked through over time. We've seen this movie a little bit before with the antibodies space and recombinant DNA. Mm-hmm. right? There's a big, I think there's a good case for optimism around the economics based on both sort of the markets that people will be picking. And you can see some of that now. I'll talk about that. And then some of the larger markets as well. And competition, another part of the economic piece, right, that I think can give us greater hope longer term. You know, as you know, when you start, these are incredibly complex products. Again, we're not punching out the pills of the 1970s in some mass factory that's just easy to just put it all together, right? These are living cells. They're expensive. They take years, if not decades, to make, and often in service of extremely small patient populations, right? We're talking many times ultra-orphan disorders, where the companies need to get their head around, is there a business to be had at some level? So that's a complexity. You know, I think a great innovation that the field has embraced to date is a lot around these value-based frameworks, right? This was sort of the gold standard. It was talked about for many years, right? In academic circles and other places, people said, geez, if we could just get people to, you know, have a potentially a one-time durable treatment, potentially it's a curable treatment. Wow, you could wrap value-based frameworks around that. You could think about payments over time or rebates back if they don't work. That would be amazing. Well, that's a modernization. We talk about modernizing health systems. That's an area where the industry has said we'll lead. And I think that's been pretty impressive. And now we're trying to get some of the same people that said they wanted that to embrace it because the future's here, right?
That's right.
So we're working on that. So I think, look, I think that can certainly play an incredibly constructive role in allowing this to go forward. You know, midterm, 5-10 years out, you know, pricing, I think, will stabilize. I don't think we'll see prices going up like we have in the last few years. I think the technology, scale, like I talked about, competition, that will help. Some, we saw this, as I mentioned, with antibodies and recombinant DNA a little bit. You see stabilization and then much greater efficiencies in manufacturing. That helps, I think, a lot of the markets that get picked, right? We've got members now that are talking about regulatory T cells, cell therapies in lupus, multiple sclerosis, RA, right? Areas like that. Well, those are areas that have, you know, competition already. The patient populations are kind of call them mid-size. They're bigger than a lot of what we see today, but they're not mass markets, right? But that you're going to launch a regulatory T-cell product into an area like an MS or a lupus or something like that. You've got competition. You can't price it too high or it's not going to work, right? So that's a moderating force, I think, right there. And I think longer term, as all these things begin hopefully to come together, we'll see not just pricing stabilization, but lower prices. And then certainly as people look to move into much larger markets like Parkinson's disease, diabetes is a big one, right?
Yeah.
I think that will help dramatically. So I am an optimist that it will work. I do think we will, if we're talking about big markets like diabetes and Parkinson's disease and other areas, we will need to modernize these healthcare systems and shift because we will be saving the system an enormous amount of money.
Yes.
But it might come with an upfront cost that's what is considered today to be difficult to digest. I will note, you know, you go back in time, roll back the clock 30 years, you know, Genzyme came out with an enzyme replacement therapy, right? Steridase, that was about $300,000 a patient per year, right? That added a zero or two to what anybody thought was reasonable pricing back then. But a lot of patients with Gaucher's disease are alive today because of it.
Yeah.
And it really helped build the modern biotech industry, right? So people could get their head around, I can go after these really small areas. It sounded crazy, right? Mm-hmm. The large pharmaceutical companies, many of them thought it was nuts, right? And Retromere and the team at Genzyme really kind of pioneered something. And then companies like where I used to work, Biogen, got their head around the multiple sclerosis market, another small one, a couple hundred thousand patients in the United States. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, you've got a biotech industry that's thriving. So there's a path forward.
A lot of super interesting stuff in there. You know, a lot of it boils down to, again, economics. It's sort of, you know, if we can get larger patient populations, then potentially to make that return on investment that requires that's required to make those massive investments. And you don't have to, you can serve more patients for lower price per patient, and then to kind of make those returns that way. I often get, when I talk about this issue myself, about, well, how does ORI, let's say, reducing cost of goods impact patient access positively if cost of goods aren't tied to price? And I say, well, you know, again, these kinds of margins that companies need to charge to get that return on investment is also driven by competition. And if you have companies that are competing for market share and want to get their products used, then they can be competitive on price. Right now they can't, because their cost of goods are too high to actually charge any less, really. You know, they're not making massive margins anyway. But if we can drive those costs down substantially, it gives them more flexibility to price in innovative ways like value-based contracting, you said, or other types of contracts that allows us to think about the economics of this in a different way. And so I think all of that kind of comes together to say that, you know, innovation is required not only scientifically, but I think economically, market access wise, and on the regulatory side. I mean, one thing that I did a couple of roundtables over the last few years post-pandemic, looking at reflections on the pandemic learnings and how might they impact the way we think about the industry moving forward.
Yes.
One of the things that I highlighted, which I think, you know, may have some validity, is, you know, one of the big things we saw with the vaccine manufacturing was that the payers in various countries said, we will buy your product if you can make it, and we will buy it for this price. So a therapy developer who had a guaranteed market, you know, we knew he had a purchaser, we knew what the economics of that purchase looked like, and we could then say, well, can we produce it at a cost that makes sense in order to achieve what we need to achieve economically? But because there's so much uncertainty with reimbursement around this, we're sort of developing at risk, spending $1 billion or more to develop a product that we're not sure is going to get covered. We're not sure how much it's going to be able to be covered. And that's not helpful for our economic model to say, you know, if Bluebird had known what the reimbursement landscape looked like in Europe, they have either made a different decision on how they develop it, or maybe they would have worked harder to make, you know, the economics work before they launched it. But because it comes after the fact, that isn't helpful, you know, for the industry. So if I don't know if there's any payers listening to the podcast, probably not. But if there are, that kind of certainty to say, well, if you could hit this price, you know, we'd buy this many doses because that economics work for us as a payer.
Right.
That kind of certainty would be welcomed by the industry, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, the key word is certitude, right? Mm-hmm. This model, I think we've got, you know, great data that suggests it worked well with buying COVID vaccines, right? It incentivized good behavior. And I think it was also a little bit of a, whether you call it kind of national pride, civic pride, a global sense of, oh my God, we've got to help the world, right? There's a lot of very goodwill. You saw a lot of organizations jump into the breach to try to help save us from COVID-19, and I think those companies should be celebrated personally.
Agreed.
But the key was that they had enough of a sense that there was the certitude that there's a market there, even though it was a temporary artificial government market. You know, incentives drive behavior, and again, I believe it was both that, and I really do believe there was a lot of sense of, my God, this is such a rare, once-in-100-year event, hopefully, that there was a lot of kind of, we'll call it global patriotism or whatever, a lot of sense of philanthropy that I believe is deep-seated in a lot of these organizations. But it helps to have a market. And for companies developing gene therapies or cell therapies, they just need the predictability, right? What I think doesn't work is if somebody says, geez, I got a great idea, and they feel like, well, is that market going to be there in 3 years? If I'm going to build the machinery, so to speak.
Or 10.
Really, we did some modeling on this some years ago and looking at the antibiotic space. This gets talked about. You need to really have some stability for people to make a commitment to discovery research and then take a long journey. It's tricky. So it can work, but it's got to be carefully thought through.
Yeah. In a similar vein, I mean, sometimes we talk about opening up access and the pricing of medicines, and the kind of critics of the industry say, oh, well, you know, we'll bankrupt the healthcare system. How can we ever afford products that cost X million dollars a year or whatever? What, you know, how should we think about that? What, you know, ultimately, there is a massive, what's often hard to predict is the benefit. So how do we, when you treat a patient, what healthcare systems and resources don't they utilize? And that's, you know, proving a negative is very difficult. But how do you think the industry, the world, the country, payers, you know, regulators should think about this issue? Because I think, you know, ultimately my gut tells me that the ROI is absolutely there. But how do we grab hold of it? How do we quantify it? Or what are the ways we should think about it?
Yeah, again, I think another important question. I mean, I hear this a lot, and I've got a strong feeling I'm going to hear it a lot more in the next 12 months. We all are, I think. And look, it's a little bit of a blink test, right? You first hear this idea of, hey, there's a gene therapy to treat this important condition or this small condition maybe that no one's ever heard of, right? Mm-hmm. And it can cost 1.5 million to 2 million to upwards of 3.5 million, right? Most people, whoa, it raises an eyebrow to say the least, right? Mm-hmm. For most people, understandably. And then it's logical to say, hey, geez, I'm concerned that can my health system, a health system, whether it's the US system or European system or whatever, can we actually digest this? And I think it's reasonable, right? For people to be skeptical. But I still haven't seen the data that says we can't digest it. And what I mean by that is, and there are different ways to cut it, I admit, but one way to cut it is if you look at, from what I understand, if you look at the Wall Street consensus data for 2028 for gene therapy, so to take CAR T and set it aside for a second, right? Just for gene therapies, which are the ones that raise the most eyebrows, right? The global revenue will be somewhere in the magnitude of $17 billion, right? So that's taking the average Wall Street, taking all the analysts and just putting them together. Where are we going to come out? $17 billion in the next, in 5 years, not now, in 5 years. So that factors in sickle cell, hemophilia, right? The big ticket ones, many other disorders, right? Well, let's talk context. Okay, if that were a standalone drug today, $17 billion, it would be something like the sixth biggest drug in the world, right? So there are five drugs that have global revenue that are more than that.
Higher than that, okay.
They go from, you know, blood thinners to rheumatoid arthritis drugs to cancer drugs, right? So a gamish of stuff, right? Okay, mm-hmm. So that's $17 billion, but then you take it, like in the US, that portion's probably, the 17's probably 7 billion or so, right? It's not half, it's a little less than half. Mm-hmm. You know, how much of that's going to trickle through, filter through a Medicaid program? You know, maybe it's 5 billion. I don't know, you know, but mm-hmm. but then you put that against other costs, right? So 17 billion, I think in the same period of time, we'll expect to see $1.6 trillion in drug spend by 2028, right? So 1%.
Percentage.
Yeah, 1% of overall drug spending. Now, you know, it's still nothing to sneeze at, $17 billion.
Still $17 billion, but it's a tiny drop in the bucket.
But the context is helpful. In Medicaid today, we spend over $700 billion, sorry, in Medicaid all in today. It'll probably grow to almost $800 billion, right? So I think it's important that we all have a data-focused discussion about can these health systems actually absorb an additional 1% of spend mm-hmm. for gene therapy. I think that's a reasonable discussion to be had. I mean, society makes a lot of choices, right? They choose to build roads and bridges and mm-hmm. pay for schools and pay for lots of things in healthcare and everything else. And a question is it worthwhile to do this? Because it really, this goes to more of an innovation question, right? We could save a lot of money if everybody, all of biotech, stopped innovating. No one would ever suggest that, right?
Yeah.
But I think we do need to have a data focused discussion about this. And again, we believe in the importance of modernizing these health systems, including on the developer side, on the biotech company side, which is why we embrace these value based frameworks. So if it looks like the drug's not working, the system doesn't have to pay for it, which I think makes eminent sense.
Yeah. And I think, you know, of those top, whatever it is, five drugs that are deriving revenues of greater than $17 billion, some of them are coming off patent. You know, some of them are going generic, and that spend will be dramatically reduced. I mean, I think I'm guessing Humira is probably one of those. And, you know, this is the way the industry goes. You have new innovation that's being reversed fully, and you have others that are coming off patent that is becoming less expensive to treat more patients. So it's a natural ebb and flow. And, you know, we're not even making an argument, we're trying to make an argument, which I think is a very valid one, to say by investing that $17 billion, we're going to save the system quite a lot of money also as a cost offset. But even leaving that, let's just say there was no financial benefit at all, which is the argument we're making right now, it still seems like it's an investment that's probably worth doing. But that is very useful, at least for my context. And yeah, $700 billion being spent by Medicare alone, or Medicaid alone on drugs. That's an astronomical number. So,
well, I think it's 700 million total. It's like 725 or 50,
all in
for Medicaid. But the point is that number is going to keep growing.
Yeah,
too.
It's massive. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, very, quite big.
Interesting. And one of the other ways we're trying to address availability, you know, when we try and model out the future, which, you know, my crystal ball doesn't work any better than yours probably, to say, well, how many products could we expect? You know, there's a famous quote from Scott Gottlieb when he was FDA commissioner that they expected to be by 2025 approving whatever it was, 25 to 50, whatever the numbers were, cell and gene therapies per year. You know, we're probably behind that, unfortunately, but, you know, there is a certain number that we will start to see, hopefully a dozen or so this year, as you said, and then maybe, you know, I think I've seen in the teens potentially projected for next year. But at some point that becomes constrained by the FDA and other regulatory bodies' ability to actually review and approve these products, because there's just not enough of the reviewers, there's just not enough staff to, you know, with something on the order of 2,700, let's call it, clinical trials going out there today.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work for the regulators. So it seems as there's been some momentum recently to try and increase the capacity of that part of the system to approve more products. And I'm curious what your, you know, most recent dialogues with, you know, Peter Marks, who I think is a very innovative leader in his own right, and what they're doing at CBER and the new Office of Tissues and Advanced Therapies, that's what they call it. Creating the OTAT, or the new super office. I'd be interested in kind of the innovation that you see happening on the regulatory side as well.
Yeah, it's a super important area. And I think Peter Marks deserves a lot of credit. He looked out, saw the horizon, saw the pipeline, saw what's going to be coming, and recognized changes are needed. And he is driving and leading that change. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for it. It's an important kind of acknowledgement. And, you know, what's he doing, right? So, as you know, he kind of collapsed OTAT in and said, look, we're going to rebuild this thing as OTP, right? The Office of Therapeutic Products. We're going to do a national search to find the right person to lead that organization. He brought in a consulting firm to help him with the restructuring. He's put some new people in place already. He's got, I think, 40 or 50 folks that had left because of turnover, and he's going to replace that. And then he's going to bring in, I think, another 100 over the next few years through PDUFA 7, right? So to expand the office, which is great news for all of us.
Yes.
Now, you still have to identify and train a lot of people in a short amount of time. And I think the challenge is, candidly, you know, he gets people in there, they stick around for a few years, and then the industry hires them.
Coaches them.
And,
yeah.
And I think that, yeah. Look, I think I think he's building the machine the right way so that he gets the right people in the door, and then thinks about how to train them in perpetuity. Cause there's just going to be turnover, right? Just, you know, it's the fact of life, I think. But I think, look, like I said, he deserves a lot of credit. He's really leaning in on this. Getting the right person, the right leader in, I think, is going to be super important. There's probably some cultural changes that need to, and organizational changes on like span of control. How many people is a reviewer? How many people how many cases can a reviewer take? How many people should be reporting into a manager? There's a lot of things like that that aren't sexy things that I think he's gotten under the hood, and he's really taken a hard look at that. I give him a lot of credit for it. Look, if we get that right and we get the European access and reimbursement, the U.S. access and reimbursement right, the sky's the limit, I think, really, because the science is not slowing down. It's accelerating. And
no, exactly.
And look, this is even happening while we're going through an incredibly tricky environment for the equity capital markets for cell and gene therapy. We make it on the other side of that, which we will. there is a great case for optimism.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not obviously not just cell and gene therapy. Biotech in general, healthcare in general, everyone's startups, we're having a tough time out there in the public markets these days. But I'd agree with you. The agency is doing, you know, unprecedented amount of regulatory innovation on their side. And from, you know, everyone complains about PDUFA fees and how they keep going up. And what you think about, you know, in operations theory, it's trying to address the bottleneck of new products coming to market. That is already, I mean, I think Peter said it in some recent comments. He said, you know, during COVID, we just had to put clinical holds because we didn't have enough people. We didn't have enough time to review things. And, you know, in the regulatory construct we're working under, you have a 2-week window to respond or whatever the things are. And we just couldn't handle the volume. And that's only going to get worse. So as an industry investing in that area, either through PDUFA fees or on other means, to ensure that that's not a bottleneck. Obviously, if you've gone through all that effort of years of clinical trials and work, and you get to the sort of end of the beginning, as I like to call regulatory approval, you know, and it's bottlenecks there because they don't have enough for reviewers. That's, you know, that's a bad outcome. So, you know, we shouldn't be quite complaining so loudly about the PDUFA fees going up, because that's an important part of the process. So. Yeah, changing gears a little bit, I've heard you talk a couple times about the importance of ethics to you personally and also to the organization, to ARM, you know, both internally and externally, and in the, you know, constituent universe that you deal with, all of the stakeholders that are in your kind of orbit. Can you just tell me a little bit why that's so important to you personally and also to the organization as we look to the future that we've been describing in detail over the last kind of 40 minutes or so?
So it really goes back to my time when I was at this small CRISPR gene editing company called Editas Medicine. I was working there and we were doing a lot of external engagement. And we'd go talk to folks on Capitol Hill. We'd talk to folks inside the Obama administration and then later the Trump administration and kind of everything in between. And we'd in patient organizations, and we'd get a lot of good questions, right? CRISPR gene editing is still in the media a lot, but there was the Klieg lights were very bright in that period of time when I was there starting in 2016. And we'd do briefings on Capitol and people would ask stuff, right? Like everything under the sun. Some of the stuff we were just talking about. Well, geez, these things seem like they're going to be really expensive. Right. Can the system afford it? Who's going to have access? Is it only going to be people that are wealthy?
Designer babies and then all that stuff.
Then it's swung over to things like, are these things well regulated? Are they too heavily regulated? Are they not regulated enough? There was work at the time being done, kind of early research, just like discovery research on embryo editing over in China. And then when you fast forward to 2018, I was in Hong Kong when this scientist, Dr. Hay, announced to the world that he had helped deliver these CRISPR gene edited twins, right? Which is talk about a searing moment, right? Yeah. It was really something. And so out of all of that, you know, we get asked things like, hey, CRISPR gene editing, you know, people working on gene drives, right? To try to edit mosquitoes so they don't deliver malaria to people. Seems like a good idea. Here's the challenge. What if the mosquitoes start falling out of the sky, right? And then
it blows up the whole ecosystem.
Right? Sounds good, but what about the other side of it, right? Yeah. Or, hey, we'd like to, people, we weren't doing it, but others would say, well, you know, we really want to use this in ag. We think there's huge applications in agriculture, right? And others would say, well, that's just companies trying to do an end run around GMOs. Why? Because technically, it's not a GMO, right? You're not introducing a foreign DNA. You're manipulating current DNA, right? So there's a lot of, on the one hand, on the other. And what I came to realize was whatever the kind of pure ethicists want to call it, these go in, when you say ethics to lots of people, they throw a lot of things into the bucket that are really about how is this technology going to be embraced or not by society writ large. And I think we saw some of this play out with COVID. Just because you get something approved, COVID vaccines, doesn't mean everybody's going to run to them and embrace them, right? Some of it's very personal. And so it goes from payers to regulators to policy leaders to patients. I think the kind of whole ecosystem of stakeholders, they see our technology with a mix of hope, yes, but a little bit of concern and skepticism, right? And some people see it with more skepticism than that. And I think it's important to really listen and engage these communities, our stakeholders, and really kind of talk it through. And so I view that as a kind of ethical, small e ethical conversation.
Yeah, and it's amazing how these topics get, they turn from maybe somewhat scientific and rational to emotional, and how misinformation spreads. But I think, you know, these kind of ethical issues are not trivial. You know, we have seen it happen in places that maybe don't have the same regulatory constructs that we have in the U.S. And we need to tread carefully into any new paradigm, any new modality that emerges. And I think it's an interesting and an appropriate focus, in my opinion. And we talked a little bit about your past history before you became CEO of Arm. Would love to just to have you tell us a little bit more about that, but also about the history of the organization. I don't know the genesis story of the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine. Would love to learn about a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me start with Arm, which is more interesting. That its background might be more interesting than mine. I think it is.
you can overweight whichever side you want.
Sometimes. Yeah, there you go. It's been around for about 13 years. Two gentlemen, Michael Werner and Maury Ruffin, co-founded it. They had both worked at Bio together, and they popped up and said, geez, there's some really interesting technology out there. Maybe we ought to think about putting together an association, essentially. And it did not have gene therapy as part of its original kind of remit. It was really around some tissue engineering and tissue repair work that was being done, and some cell therapy work that was being done. And those were kind of hot fields 13 years ago. And only later did kind of gene therapy emerge as a kind of interesting thing to fold into it. So that's why the initial term is regenerative medicine. It kind of goes back to the history of the organization. Mm-hmm. And so we're comprised of about 475 members. It's many of the members are biotech companies that might be small and private to publicly traded, and with some things in the pipeline. To a number of them, obviously, are out. We talked about earlier, are launching real products, which is great. And then we go all the way up to big organizations like Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, Sanofi, and others. And then we've got a couple dozen patient organizations, rare disease patient organizations are members, mm-hmm. as well as some of the prominent academic medical centers. And then we have a lot of folks that are kind of the backbone of the field, right? The tools companies, the suppliers, you know this well.
We don't say tools on this podcast, Tim. Okay. Enabling technology companies. That's what
there you go. Enabling technology.
If you can tell your analyst friends on Wall Street, that would be good too.
Better said. Yeah. I mean, but it's a lot of important organizations that make up this bigger ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And really it gets to like our kind of the core of our mission, right? Which is really built around, as I mentioned earlier, kind of patients are our true north. How do we build a community within cell and gene therapy and tissue repair and tissue engineering that's in service of those patients, and try to help modernize health systems so that they can embrace this future of this highly disruptive technology. And we do a lot around the community, right? We hold two big meetings a year, one in we call our meeting on the Mesa, and one our meeting on the Mediterranean. And then we do a lot of other work with the FDA and other bodies to try to really have people better understand the future of medicine.
Awesome. And remind me again how you got co-opted to take this role. Oh, yeah. and what your ambitions are for the organization moving forward.
Yep. I do not have a science background. I'm a reformed lawyer by training. I spent almost 25 years in the biotech industry, including with Glaxo, Biogen, Cubist Pharmaceuticals. I mentioned Editas Medicine, and then a company called Exilio. And I was sort of working away happy there. And I got a phone call from a friend that said, hey, there's this opening at the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine. I knew my predecessor, Janet Lambert, quite well. Mm-hmm. I spoke to Janet about the role, and she's incredibly persuasive. and the more I thought about it, I've done a fair amount in government affairs, public policy, communication over the years. I've got had and continue to have enormous respect for Janet and the organization that she had built over her 5-year tenure. And I've known Michael Werner and Moy Ruffin for years. And so for me, I thought about it, and I thought, at this point in my career, this might be an interesting thing to change up. You know, I've only been in for-profit biotech companies. I'd never been in a nonprofit before, but it's been great. We've sort of set out to do a few things. Really, we put together a 3-year strategic plan for our board, which we got approved back in January. We brought in some, I think, some really strong biotech talent in the form of Mark Battaglini as our chief strategy officer and Rita Johnson Green, our chief operating officer, both joined this year. We've got a strong team that was in place before, so we just kind of added more firepower to it, and we're trying to really make it, you know, as a biotech centric, really, I would say, top flight international advocacy association. I think it is that. We're just trying to make it even stronger. So I think so far so good.
Awesome. Yeah. No, I've interacted with Mike Lemicki on your staff, or Lemicki. I always get his name wrong. Apologies, Mike. But we just did a Ask the Expert session with him that we'll be having some content out for, and the work that he's done with the industry and some of the ACEL work, I think, is fantastic. You know, kind of trying to move the industry, which is in, as you said, a little bit still in its kind of development phase, but the earlier we can develop standards that we can all shoot at rather than having us all reinventing the wheel. And those are good things. So, you know, thank you for the work that you and your team do. It's greatly appreciated by the industry for sure. We are approaching the end of our time together, and thank you again for spending an hour or so with us. I always like to ask this question of my guests, really, to understand, you know, what's the kind of one piece of advice you'd give for either people that are in the industry now or people that want to get into the industry? You know, I always joke, there's probably very few high schoolers that are listening to this podcast, but you know, obviously the talent shortage is a big topic of discussion often in these kinds of discussions. But, you know, what does the industry need? And what is, you know, what should people be thinking about from your perspective as it relates to cell and gene therapy?
Look, I'm a big believer in people and culture of organizations that we're going through. We talked about earlier, this incredibly challenging kind of backdrop of where the equity capital markets are. And there's a rightful focus on organizations that are preserving their capital and trying to think about how do they stretch the cash they do have to longer timelines. And it's been a challenging couple of years for sure. Nevertheless, I think an enduring, you know, truth is that, you know, a big rate limiting factor on building companies is talent. And in cell and gene therapy, it's definitely true. I saw it when I went to Editas Medicine, right? We were looking for where could we go steal talent that really understood CRISPR gene editing? Well, there weren't any companies working on it.
There's
right?
two CRISPR labs in the world. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So where'd we go? We went and we went upstream. We went to academia and pulled a lot of people out of our founders' labs, right? Great. Super talented. Never worked for a company before, right? What do you mean I got to put together goals? What do you mean I've got it, right? So there's all kinds of interesting challenges in putting together great organizations, and it takes so much time and thought and prep work and frankly a lot of trial and error. And I think investing in people and culture is organizations that do that really well will stand the test of time for sure.
No, I agree with that, and I spend the vast majority of my time when I think about Ori's development as a company on the people and the culture. I mean, the old shorthand of culture beats strategy. It's sort of like you don't know what's coming, but if you got the best people, you know, you can handle it, that kind of thing. And this industry needs the best people because it's about as complicated a puzzle as we can get in this industry that needs a lot of bright people focused on solving these problems for patients. Ultimately, as we said earlier, you know, we want the same things, and that's for every patient who needs access to any of these incredible therapies to be able to get it. And only the best people will get us to that endpoint. So excited for that future. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you again so much for joining me. It's been educational for me. Great to see you in two dimensions, and look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks' time, I think.
You bet. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Jason. This was great.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit us at oribiotech.com.